Octa Non Verba is a show that's raw and real, featuring hard-hitting interviews with people that live by the ethos of actions, not words. Marcus Aurelius Anderson is a TEDx speaker, best-selling author, veteran, and leadership and mindset coach. With this show, you get to join Marcus as he goes inside the minds and experiences of the world's most successful warriors, leaders, entrepreneurs, and experts. With each episode, you're going to get the philosophies, concepts, tactics, and strategies these leaders use to turn adversity into victory. Live an extraordinary life based on actions, not words. Now, here's your host, Marcus Aurelius Anderson.
Octa Non Verba is a Latin phrase that means actions, not words. If you want to know what somebody truly believes, don't listen to their words. Instead, observe their actions. I'm Marcus Aurelius Anderson, and my guest today truly embodies that phrase. Sarah Kernighan inspires and influences others with her insight, imagination, and initiative so that they are moved to choose inner action over isolation in order to improve with inch stones. I love that concept. To give a little bit more about her and SaturdaysStory.com, this idea of coming through from understanding autism. As a mother of two non-speaking autistic children, Sarah is a passionate neurodiversity advocate, challenging stigmas and embracing vulnerability using her inch stones versus milestones mentality to celebrate neurodiverse individuals and their potential. Her journey is more than a story. It is a global call to action for understanding and inclusion in companies worldwide. Sarah, I know I put a long string on that kite, but thank you for being here today and thank you for your time. We were discussing earlier about this understanding of suffering and how that oftentimes the avoidance of suffering causes more suffering in the long term. Mm-hmm. And for me, this idea that I always say that the greater the weight, the greater the weight, the greater that we face, we wait to face adversity, the greater the weight, the greater the waste of that adversity once we actually do face it. Mm-hmm. Can you explain to me this concept of being able to suffer in a way that's...
I had never experienced... Well, first of all, thank you for having me. I love Octa Non Verba in every bit and every iota and every part of what those letters put together mean. I lived a very typical milestones hit life up until having children. And when my daughter Millie was diagnosed with autism around the age of 2.5, the pain that comes along with a diagnosis of a child, of one of your children, is really the grief that the life that you anticipated and the life that you had been sold, the dream that you had been sold, no longer exists. And there's a wonderful poem that I give in a lot of my talks, which talks about you prepare to go to Italy your entire life as a young woman who wants to become a mother or a man that wants to become a father. And you prepare for Italy and you learn about Italy and you learn the phrasing and you learn and you decide where you're going to go in the map. And when you land, after getting on the flight, and you land in Holland, and the flight attendant says, this is where you will be. But you're not, you never landed in a world of pestilence and famine and disgusting humans. You landed in the world of tulips and windmills and Rembrandts. But your whole life has been watching people coming and going from Italy. And so for me, going back to the suffering and grief, you have to sit for a moment in the hot loneliness that is the fact that you are not in Italy and you are in a place that you never anticipated you were going to be in. And I think by acknowledging it, sitting with it, allowing it to pass through, the moving through that pain allows for the suffering to dissipate, because you end up being so mindful of where your feet are, so mindful of where your choice, your conscious choice of motherhood. There's so many ways to parent, right? There's so many ways that we were just bombarded this day and age with theories on what parenting is best, you know, conscious parenting, gentle parenting, authoritative parenting. But what I found boiled down to is all of those can be true all at once. I'm here as a parent to this specific child. And how that conscious choice, once I got through the news and the aftershock of what that diagnosis was, it brought me so into the present moment as a mother that it made for arguably what I believe was to be my motherhood experience. I became who I was because of what of that diagnosis from my daughter and then subsequently my son.
And it's so true. So many times we end up subconsciously pushing the brake on ourselves mm-hmm. with this resistance, with this denial, with trying mm-hmm. to push this thing to the side. There's an analogy that they have in the book called Already Free, where they say if we take discomfort and we try to push it to the side, the more we continue to do that, the more I eventually start to go around. And now my entire mm-hmm. life rotates around this thing.
Rotates around that thing.
That I'm mm-hmm. unable to face. And then mm-hmm. vicariously, my family's life rotates mm-hmm. around my lack of capacity.
That's right.
To embrace the reality of the situation. And now I'm doing a huge disservice to them, let alone send them on a trajectory from ethically, morally, mm-hmm. that does not serve them. And then I have the audacity to be surprised when all of a sudden there's incongruencies afterwards.
Exactly.
Right?
I don't mean to laugh at it, but it's just, there's these false narratives and these stories that we tell ourselves of what is happening or has happened that actually don't match up with what they being experienced and the actual event of what you experience. And yes, I mean, I love that I can visually see what you're saying. Like it becomes then the core of your existence is the denial of the reality and the truth. And it's almost then permeates and becomes the only thing that you think of and the only reason that you're getting up every day. And it was a very conscious choice to become more than a caretaker and make these diagnoses a part of just what my life is to be, not that I am to become the diagnoses and to immerse and to be confused and questioning and wrangling with the why over and over again. You know, I am someone's child too. So their hope for me is for me to become the best version of who I am. I'm not here to then just to succumb to this black hole of grief, denial, and like you said, pushing away, where then I just become engulfed by the denial. And, you know, unfortunately, specifically in the special needs parenting world, I do believe, and I know obviously we could probably go to the end of the internet on this topic, but, you know, Ryan Holiday and in Stoicism, there is such an ego in the way for most of these parents that I come in touch with for one-on-one peer counseling. They're so angry and they feel so hurt by something that doesn't have to hurt them. And they're placing, and their ego is just like leading, like everything about it is like, well, that's not supposed to what I'm supposed to experience. That's not who I am. Well, who told you that? And it's become one of the biggest conversations that I've had over and over again in a one-to-one peer-to-peer, you know, autism mom to autism mom sessions is them saying, I want this for my child. That's what I want for my kid. And I would say, that's so wonderful you want that. I don't know if you realize that wanting something versus what is the best for your child is, have you faced the music on that yet? And what story that is creating? And like, to your point, the story then becomes what you're not doing and what your child's not doing versus what they are doing. I actually ran into a friend just this morning who was so sad when her son got diagnosed. And she came to me and she said, how do I heard that you are so tied to the developmental pediatrician in New York City and Central Jersey. Who can I get to remove the diagnoses from my son's file? And I said, do you want Lucas to be anything but Lucas? She's like, no, I just love him so much. I said, well, what is removing a diagnosis going to do? It's not going to change who Lucas is. And I think when people start to realize that, they do their own inner work and their ego, they move their ego out of the way and they start to live for who they are and who their children are and the unique experience it is to, and I believe the gift of raising a neurodivergent child. There's so much this world can benefit from the way that they see the world and the complexity of it.
It's so true. And even that emotion that we attach to this hardship that we try to avoid, again, until we face it, it permeates everything. It influences everything. It has a residue, this texture that comes over the lens of everything that we see. Mm-hmm. And until we, when I spoke to Robert Greene on the show, he talked about this idea of this radical realism, this idea of just accepting it for what it is. Mm-hmm. What you're describing, this idea of ego, people need to understand that everything in this world is not about them. Or their expectations, or their lack of expectations, or those expectations being met, or even realistic. It's like, that's fantastic that you would like to have this thing. Right now, that's irrelevant.
Yeah.
The reality is this. Mm-hmm. What are you willing to do to move forward? And then back to this notion also of, where is the evidence that this is actually harming you?
Right, right.
It's not. It's harming your ego. It's harming the fact of what your expectation was. Mm-hmm. Adapt that expectation, reorient now in real time. Mm-hmm. Because if you truly care about your child, that's what you should be caring about, not what you think or what the stigma is or what somebody else may or may not think in the process of trying to raise this human.
I think, you know, I'm sure you would agree with this in any sort of feat that you tackle. My trajectory and my choice to do that for specifically Mac and Millie, my younger two with autism, is not in competition with another person's choice to parent their autistic child. It's, you know, there's a phrase in the special needs community of, if you've met one child with autism, you've met one child with autism. And I believe that that's the same for truly any human, right? I mean, I don't think that any child should be compared in a developmental way to any other child. I understand that we have frameworks of education and society that have become standardized norms. However, in the way that you create this little, you know, cocoon of your home and allow for there to be so many different choices to make that don't harm any of the others, but that are specific to them, it's so freeing as a parent. You know, I was doing a talk last night with LinkedIn's families and that are in their Asia offices. And the one employee said, how do you stay resilient to parenting and disciplining your neurodivergent child versus your neurotypical one? Because it's such a different way of parenting, because you really can't discipline. I can't discipline my younger to the same I do my oldest. And what I said is that what I've learned through my children being who they are, and this might be different for theirs, is that my younger two have 100% receptive language skills through the roof. I actually talk to them exactly how I would talk to my oldest in terms of being disciplined. They might not physically react the same way, but if I look at my daughter and she swipes the ice cream out of my son's hand, which she did at the beach last week, and takes it, and she took a bite of it, and I say, and she is death grip on that ice cream cone, and she's got another one already. Like, she already has one. She takes it, and I say, Millie, I know that you want both. That's your brother's. We do not take your brother's ice cream. And she looks at me and with her glasses down, like, and gives it back. Exactly like a typical 8.5-year-old that was put in her place. She knows she has an ice cream cone. But because I assume competence, I assume that her receptive language, and I assume that she knows exactly what she's doing, because I've witnessed it over and over again. If I talk with her like she understands, which she does, we end up being able to get to the same level of disciplining, even though it looks wildly different. Because all I'd have to really do, if my oldest did that, was say, Morgan. And she'd go, sorry, Mom. I just wanted to try his. I'd be like, I get it. We don't take your brother's ice cream. But it's really the same. It's just the acceptance of who they are and parenting to that child. Let me also pause. It's freaking exhaustive. This is exhaustive, right? It's exhaustive. If I'm not doing my best in that parenting sense to make them the most independent, self-advocate selves that they can be, whether they're typical or neurodivergent, I don't think I'm doing my job and my role as a mother.
Well, and you pointed that out, that again, you're not just being artificially toxically positive in this.
No.
You're accepting this radically for what it is and saying, okay, there will be some challenges, but what mm-hmm. doesn't have challenges?
Right.
And so if that's the case, how am I going to embrace this? And then let's also be honest. What are the alternatives?
What are the alternatives? Yeah, I mean, exactly. The alternative is denial of how their growth is going to happen, to be sad and arguably continually grief stricken by yeah. what they're not doing. And, you know, I'm sure you would know, even just as a observer of or avid, you know, learner of neurodivergency, you know, autism, they get really honed in on certain things, like love. My daughter is obsessed with the alphabet. She is fully loves the alphabet. She loves letters. She loves anything that has the alphabet. If I have a shirt that says NYC on it, it's the first thing she points to. If you can look at it as a beautiful thing they love to do, it ends up becoming just the first step of to your point about widening their development and growth. But you have to accept that that's how she wants to learn. And my son is much more into the sensory and the lights and the colors and that. So you can pair that with, you love that red button so much. Do you know what else is red? The apples. Go get a red apple for mommy. But that's not going to work with my Millie. And that's certainly not how I taught Morgan her colors. But it's just looking at it through a different, you know, lens with each kid. And I think knowing that the growth can continue to happen and that it's going to look so different than what any of your peers are doing is one of the biggest lessons in being here in the moment and the power of now, without a doubt. I wouldn't trade my children for the world because I would not be able to live in the moment, in the present, and be so full of gratitude for what I'm learning as a 40-year-old woman now. It's because of my children being who they are.
Well, it's also this understanding of how to adapt and see what's really going on in real time. We mm-hmm. talk about people understand that there are 5 love languages. Mm-hmm. Even in leadership, it's similar. There's some people that want you to be direct and succinct. Some people that need you to circumvent and go really around the subject before they get to that place of understanding. Mm-hmm. It's the same thing with a child, right? You have to understand, you meet them where they are. For one, it's about anything that has letters. For another one, it's about colors. That's fine. Let's accentuate the positive in this. Let's meet them where they are in this. Let's use this commonality to help them succeed and further their development in this arena, as opposed to just saying, that bugs me that they're fixated with colors or stimming or anything else that, you know, nonverbal children do, correct?
Yeah, I mean, there's a my daughter does this when she's really happy. She hits her heart and she goes like, and it's mostly during song or reading books over and over again, and that's her way. I've realized of her way of saying this feels really good. Like I feel really good right now, and it's not going to be a laughter or you know, the elation that you might hear of a kid coming off a ride being like, that was so much fun, but she just goes like this, and it's. Again, it doesn't have to be as hard as people make it. Like to your point about, is this really happening? Is what you're saying that you feel like you're experiencing, is that actually what's happening? Or is that something that you've thought that I've been told this is going to be exponentially harder. So you're right, it is exponentially harder. I've found that even in the, you know, gross motor skills, fine motor skills area, that they don't tend to catch up per se with their typical peers, but it, as I look and have modeling of friends that have, you know, older children or autistic individuals that I'm friends with that are in their 30s, the skills that, you know, have been so forced upon us from a milestone era, is not really indicative of success at all. You know, my friend Carrie Magro is one of, he's known as the autistic professional speaker. He's in his 30s, self-advocate, speaks all over the country, you know, opens up for Temple at major conventions. And he can't ride a bike to save his life. He's like, I can't button a shirt. Oh, well. I mean, it's just like, when have we become so scripted to these 8.5 by 11 sheets at a pediatrician's office? What, for me as, you know, a new mom to say, like, I did a good job. I didn't do anything. Like, my daughter didn't roll over because I coached her to roll over at 3 months. She just innately figured out through being a human and one with a typical brain that this is her hand and this was her hand. And Mac and Millie didn't figure that out as quickly. And that's okay. Guess what? They're walking. They can run. It's really interesting once you just, again, it sounds so easy to say, but you just take a deep breath to what the potential is and lean into competency over deficiency. And it's just freeing. It's so freeing. I hope through talking about how Millie and Mac are developing that companies and institutions start to realize that how they see the world and how they learn will benefit industries going forward. That's become a thread of mine that I never really thought was part of my mission, but someone in my circle pointed it out that the way that the Millie and Mac absorb things, specifically like a sporting event or a movie or a concert, they'll watch over and over again. They're so satisfied by that repetition. And specifically with my daughter, she will watch college football and NFL football all day long in the fall. Does not even care. She's a song. I could narrate and sing. Her life could be a Broadway show if she could choose. That would be me singing her life to her. But on Saturdays and Sundays in the fall, she will sit there and watch football all day. And she's watching it in a way like, they didn't do that last time. Like, what? I'll catch her on her iPad watching an Alabama national championship game, the same one. She's 8. And I just wonder, I have to hold out. It's not hope. It's just this light indication that her mind could potentially be a positive for competition or for, you know, an institution to see things differently, to have a competitive edge.
I know a few CEOs and founders and co-founders that are on the spectrum. And as you say, there are certain things that they're not good at, but they were good enough to find people around them to hire into those positions. Mm-hmm. And man, when it comes to whatever their profession is, if it's IT, if it's coding, whatever it is, they have this superpower that allows them to see light years ahead. I'm not just talking 2 or 3 moves. I'm talking...
Oh, multiple.
Right. And when they see that, and now they can give that to an integrator, or they can give that to a person that can paint the vision. It's like you said, it's exponential to anything else that we see right before us.
It is. I mean, and again, like, what is life if not that? Like, I really feel that in my bones of like, when I get to witness my child start to do these things, and because of me hoping to allow her and him to become the best versions of themselves, I can then celebrate those in a way, even though they probably, which I believe that they know that they are different and that they absorb the world differently than maybe their sister does, but that it's still to be celebrated. And it's still to, and that's where I, Stone mentality is so powerful, is that because I'm so acutely aware of how their growth is going and progressing, I am charged with celebrating first and foremost. There's no one else that's more charged with celebrating that. And it's not from a sense of trying to say that my child's better or, I'm constantly pleasing them. It's not praise per se. It's acknowledgement of, oh my gosh, I saw that too, but you saw it before me. You know, you catch these autistic kids who, you know, don't make good eye contact, looking over at you like, mom saw that? I saw that, and it's the sixth sense, you know, very persnickety kind of detail, but the attention to it is the good stuff. It's the good stuff. And I see it more and more as my younger two age. And it's, I have to believe that it's because of harnessing and not squashing what they're innately choosing to engage and how they engage the world, and not trying to shape shift that to be typical. Or, you know, there's a term called masking in the neurodivergent community, which is trying to, you know, to be typical. And so you get really good at covering your autistic or neurodivergent traits. And I think the more you just lean into having the safe space for them to do that through their, you know, stimming or, you know, my son really loves jumping. I mean, it's just, it's typical for an autistic little boy. But then I think, he jumped, another 6-year-old boy doesn't love to jump. You know, he just loves to jump 10 times as much.
It's also
this great for my couch, but you know.
Well, it also shows that why we may be talking about very specific attributes or characteristics. It's the same with a child that does not have the neurodivergence.
Yes.
If you have one child that happens to love to read, one that loves music, one that loves athletics, we don't try to push the one that's not athletic to read or study music. We don't try to push the one that loves music to go out and play football or something that they don't enjoy. Let's just find the thing that they like, the thing that they are naturally, this attribute that they already have sort of ingrained within them. And as you were saying, it may, if we're resistant to it, it may seem more difficult. But again, what has to change? Our child can't change this, but we can adapt. We can change. Mm-hmm. We can innovate. We can reorient in a way that truly mm-hmm. says, okay, if that's the case. Mm-hmm. And I have found in my experience, again, this idea that adversity is a gift, mm-hmm. it puts you in a position that you would never have chosen normally.
No.
But once you're there, it gives mm-hmm. you a perspective that you couldn't have gotten any other way. Mm-hmm. And there's no way you would have voluntarily found that. And then when you have that perspective, now you start to see these other vantage points again mm-hmm. that maybe the other 90% of the world doesn't. That's okay, because that's now to our advantage. That's now something that we can really harness to serve us in any arena that we enter.
Gosh, I mean, you just hit the last, whatever arena that we enter. I think, you know, I'm also a real avid scholar of Brené Brown's research on shame and vulnerability. Mm-hmm. And I love that she always says, she's like, when you're in the arena, do not tap out. There's a reason that you're in there, and there's going to be doors being lifted left and right. Don't tap out. And there is a general pattern to tap out when things get too hard. And I believe it only does the trajectory of, you know, the natural progress of things. It delays. If you want to talk about delays, the delay is actually not the actual typical milestone delay. It's actually the delay in the potential for your child. And, you know, we can talk about research and stuff on in the neurodivergent minds, but the brain's plasticity under 5 is, I'm sure you know, is wildly huge. And once they hit 5, it's a different way of, you know, circuitry development. And I always thought about that in two ways. One, yes, it's plastic and it has much more, you know, ability to change. But what do I really want to change? Do I really want to change that plasticity, or do I just want to accentuate the circuitry that they actually have? Now, for me, you know, Mac and Millie have a comorbid diagnosis of apraxia, which is an oral motor planning issue. So their brain knows what it wants to say, but their musculature doesn't have the connective response. Now, that to me feels more like the plasticity of the brain and how I can help with that. But the way they actually think, I just wanted to encourage that circuitry, not change it, which kind of pushes the envelope with some in the autistic community.
Of course. But that's why you're doing what you're doing.
Right.
When I spoke to Dr. Mark Goulston, he says, and he was a psychiatrist for over 30 years, taught FBI negotiators like how to do their job, taught Chris Voss what he was doing. Mm-hmm. Incredible executive coach before he recently passed away. But he said, when you're listening to people, he says, people want to feel heard. Mm-hmm. They want to feel seen. Mm-hmm. But most importantly, they want to feel felt. Mm-hmm. So you being a mother and having to put yourself with this application of pragmatic empathy, truly being in their place, what are they feeling? Mm-hmm. What is this emotion? what is their response? What is the reaction? This serves you not only for your child, but now you can recognize it as a characteristic within another person, or mm-hmm. you just still see this other person going through, as we were discussing, hardship, difficulty, adversity, resistance. So many times we find that, especially in society, we're conditioned to believe that once it's difficult, that's when it's okay to tap out. But the reality is, once it's difficult, this is truly when you're actually getting to the place of learning.
Yes.
This is truly the friction that sharpens you if you're willing to embrace that. And there is a lot further that we can go in those capacities, but we have to have the courage to embrace this discomfort and welcome it in a way, welcome that suffering and say, this is going to make me better when I'm on the other side of it. Mm-hmm. And as so often is the case, once we've gone through it and we've looked back upon it, it's not nearly as daunting as we thought it was. Mm-mm. We realize that we're not made out of porcelain. We're not fragile. Mm-mm. And then we also start realizing, man, there's a lot of other areas where I'm under-indexing unnecessarily, yes. artificially. Mm-hmm. So how long have I been living within this belief system that was simply, again, my own narrative that I was telling myself all along?
Mm-hmm. I mentioned before, I had such a typical trajectory from, you know, let's say birth to 25 or 26. And my first big experience with pain and hardship was I had a terrible, arguably fringe line postpartum psychosis with really deep anxiety postpartum. And I got through that and had wonderful, I was living in New York at the time and had a wonderful women's health psychiatrist that worked with me to get me through that through, you know, therapy and medication and, you know, all the right positive body ownership, postpartum, you know, research-based tools. And I remember getting through that and, you know, it was maybe a half a year where I was healed from that specific event. And I thought to myself, silly, looking back now, that was the hard thing that my life was giving me. Like there, I did it. Like, look at me. I like really took such initiative to work through that. And I mean, to the point, Marcus, where I was speaking about, you know, postpartum and maternal postpartum experiences, because I realized that was another element of motherhood that was not being discussed enough, was that as this fourth trimester and the hormones and the just, you know, sheer exhaustion factor of in birth and all these things. But at a certain age where I thought life would hand you a few of these, and it was, if you got through one, you're like, I know what pain now is. Check that. Like, and I love now that I know that to not be true, and to know even now in multiple phases of experience of chapters of pain and suffering that there is going to be a weight of that again. I know there will be, and it doesn't scare me anymore. It doesn't, I don't fear this unknown. I get asked quite a bit, you know, what are Mac and Millie's future? What does your future look like? What does it hold? Do you ever fear what will happen when you're gone? Or what, you know, what will happen if, as they, you know, age out of the school system? At the risk of sounding naive, I don't even think that far ahead. I don't. My goal every day is to do the next right thing for each of my kids and for myself. And I believe that becomes a really genuine compass of life. And if I am having Mac and Millie become the best versions of themselves today, Friday, April 12th, 2024, then I go to bed pretty happily every night. And I know that it might sound like I'm unprepared, but it's actually the opposite. I'm actually more prepared for all the unknowns because of that choice to do so.
Yeah, this is truly a VUCA environment in which you're embarking, fall to unknown.
Oh yeah.
Having said that, the reality is we're all embarking on the same horizon, if we're very honest.
Right.
There's no guarantee, first of all, that we will have the next day. Mm-hmm. And as you were saying, this very present mentality, whether you be a CEO, a leader, a father, a mother, any sort of capacity where your decisions matter. Even in poker, they say it's not about your you're not supposed to win. Right. You are supposed to make the best decision that you possibly can in this moment.
Right.
Should I get involved in this hand? No, mm-hmm. That's the best decision. Mm-hmm. If I don't play a hand for 2 hours, that's maybe the best decision. If I'm in the chaos, if I'm in the face of adversity and I can still maintain that structural integrity under pressure and make the best decision, irrespective of how much pressure is on me, then that again is the goal. And lots of times when we do that on a long enough timeline, mm-hmm. Now it's hard for us to lose. Now we're able to go to that next place, which
right.
comes back to your point of these inch stones. Mm-hmm. I always talk about them as micro adversities, these like smaller things that are these smaller chunks, these smaller bites. Lao Tzu's concept of I'm not building a wall, I'm just laying one brick as perfectly as I possibly can mm-hmm. right now. Mm-hmm. And then I try to do it again tomorrow and I try to do it later. But if we can just focus on those things, even as in mountain warfare school, if I looked how high that mountain was, that thing would crush me.
Yeah.
But I'm just trying to get to that next foothold, that next spike, that next place, that next breath.
I think special needs parenting requires you to be an aid in a greater capacity physically mm-hmm. to your children. But it is because of that, like I actually specifically took, you say climbing to the next foothold. I took my oldest and a friend of hers and my daughter Millie to an indoor climbing wall. I had to help Millie the entire time. There's no, you know, on belay. There, I am right there. I am right there with my hands under her tush. But watching her take that all in a different way is allowing me then to see how she's seeing it. It's like the more, while I'm aiding her, she's actually aiding my vision on how to take in the world. So I don't ever see it as a level of less than. You know, there's such a label of that they're less than, that they can do less, they don't do as much. And it's actually not that at all. But because they have to be supported in a way, because the world is set up how it is, it looks like they can't do as much. And it's actually what you're saying about Lao Tzu. It's actually, no, they're actually only focusing on the next brick. Did you know? It's like, did you not notice that, y'all? Like that's what she's doing. She's only focusing on the next brick. And the sensory part of that is the ability to tune out almost. I mean, Millie and Mac truly only know how to be themselves. There is not a single thing that society has infiltrated to their mind and hearts that has told them they should be something that they aren't. That's honestly, like for me, as a, you know, very like feminine, girly, you know, blonde Manhattanite woman, I'm influenced by society. They certainly aren't. It's the best lesson to learn. They are just building that next brick as perfectly as they can. And they need a little help. Who doesn't?
I was going to say, these are all lessons that they keep telling us, people keep saying now.
Yes.
Come back to the present moment. Focus on the process.
Yeah.
Don't worry about, right? All these things. And again, being authentically who the hell you are. A lot of people don't remember who they were before society told them who mm-hmm. they were or stacked upon them an expectation of what the next thing should be. And then again, but that's the beauty of adversity because it burns all that stuff away. Mm-hmm. It strips away all the BS, mm-hmm. all the pretense, all the masks. And once that falls down, mm-hmm. Once we have that weight off of us, it's actually liberating. And now we can boldly move forward in the direction that we should be oriented towards already, as opposed to trying to walk against it sideways or backwards in a way that doesn't serve us to our strength.
I think, like you're saying, within the adversity too, once you're open to those experiences, you then are able to learn. You're more agile in your learning capacity, right? Like, which is again why I interact and travel so much with my younger two, is that people say to me, well, that's rocking their routine. They're routine-based kids. They love structure and organization to what they and how to anticipate. Well, I do too. But the interesting part about it is that my 8.5-year-old who doesn't speak knows exactly how to board an airplane. She knows exactly what to do. Probably better than most 8-year-olds do. and like knows and sits down and buckles. And it's like, so what the world was saying is that that's breaking her of her routine. But the irony is that she actually, once she experiences it and knows that that is part of her repertoire of routines, she probably is the best travel. I always joke, I would travel to China with Millie. She's like, I got my iPad, I got my headphones, I got mom, and she brings the snacks. Like she actually probably won't challenge that routine, but you have to establish it. My daughter, my oldest, is dragged around to therapies and related services for her younger siblings. That's just the name of her life. And the opposite is that her brother and sister are dragged to basketball games on the weekends. And as you can imagine, the court sounds and the atmosphere and the bleachers and the crowd and the buzzer. I mean, it was a lot at first when my oldest started getting into, you know, more competitive basketball. And I thought, I'm not going to let my family as a whole not show up for their sister. I mean, they might not be able to stay and support in a typical manner, but we're going to go. And it took about a year to get my son to fully be able to sit through a basketball game. And it started off with me sitting on the court. This was 18 months, 2 years ago. So he's 4.5, 5 at the time, fully facing me. His head is buried into my chest. My hands are covered over his ears. And I'm rocking him on the floor of the court while the game is going on. And I'm going, we're at a basketball game. We're at your sister's basketball game. She's on the court right now. Every so often, he'd look, turn back. He's just watching, listening to his show, listening to his songs. He'd look up this. I'd see the buzzer countdown. And, you know, that's And I'd like, consciously noted, I plug his ears as tight as I could, and I'd slowly start to like give it 1 second, then do it. Brother just walks right up into the stands right now. We sit in the top corner. It's a little more contained. It feels a little like more of a nook. And Mac and Millie are just part of the families that come to the basketball games now. But people always go, well, how did you do that? I engaged with what the reality was. There's a court, it squeaks, there's a ball, it dribbles, there's a buzzer, it sounds. How can Mac be okay with that environment over time? And they're now just siblings of a basketball player. And while I know my 11-year-old tween doesn't like to, you know, give accolades to her mother and, you know, say thank you so much for bringing Mac and Millie, I'm going to leave a little bit. I don't like to use the word hope a lot, but I'm pretty hopeful that when she hits her 30s and 40s, she's going to remember that her brother and sister were there to support her as much as she was for them. So, well,
and it's a testament to that gradual exposure kind of therapy, right? Mm-hmm. You're just slowly, and it's like anything else, weightlifting, going for a walk, going for a run, mm-hmm. Any sort of conversation, cognitive capacity, all those things we learn.
Yeah.
I called it an adversity scale. Mm-hmm. So we have that 10 on our scale, whatever the hardest thing is, you were mentioning postpartum. At that point in your life, that was your 10. So you're like, oh, anything from here down, I'm good. And most of life is going to be below that. But sometimes adversity comes up and clicks it up a notch. And it says, hey, this is what the reality is. Mm-hmm. And we go through the 5 stages. We go through denial, anger, bargaining, mm-hmm. depression, and acceptance. But even that exposure to those things, those 5 steps, mm-hmm. with a lot of pressure on us, we get better at going directly from 1 to 5. We don't skip the steps. We accept it entirely. And now we say, okay, this is going to be difficult. I get that. I have no misconceptions about that.
Yeah, there's no misconception that I'm not jumping through any hoop to get to the end goal. There's no, trust me, it's like, I know we're not jumping a level at all.
Absolutely. But once we're there, like you say, now it says, okay, this is this inchstone component. This is what the hardship was. And now look at like you said, your kids are able to be in that environment.
Yeah, it's so cool. It's like the coolest thing ever that, you know, then we go to the, it's so basic and it's so simple. It's not easy, but it's simple in that we just go and do everything that any other typical family is afforded to do. It's going to look a lot different. And the ignition energy and the sustainment energy is a heck of a lot more intense. But we're there and we're engaging and we're living and we are living and we are experiencing. And I really believe that everyone that has watched those lived experiences that, you know, directly in my world have benefited from seeing those inchstone moments. They see it. They've seen and remember those moments where I was only able to be there on the court for 5 minutes and walk out and come back in and walk out. It's a modeling. I mean, if anything, what is parenting if not modeling, right? You're modeling for what a full adult human can and should be, look like. And that modeling of Mac and Millie's development, even to other children, has been just such a positive. It's such a positive for everyone involved. And, you know, I do believe that the more I talk about what they can do and how they can do it, that in 10, 15 years, obviously alongside the world, hopefully doing more and other people in similar fashions, it will create space in the workplace for the neurodivergent mind to be simply a part of the HR structure of any organization. They're doing that. I mean, these AI companies are doing it.
They are, and it shows us the power of inclusion, mm-hmm. but not in this arbitrary way where we have a bunch of people that are unqualified to be in a certain arena. It's not like that at all. I'm saying that there are certain advantages, certain strengths that they have. Why not bring them into this arena in a way that actually not only serves them and contributes, but now they're able to be a part of a company. And now the company is getting this, again, that's a secret weapon. It's this thing that other people turn their head to, or they don't want to have to worry about. It's like, listen, the whole John Boyd idea is like, listen, look for the mismatches, look for the opportunities there.
Yeah. I one of the topics that rose to the top after my first year in talking about neurodivergency and advocacy in live speaking forums was how receptive Gen Z is to the inclusion of neurodivergent employees. And, you know, even within their social framework and frameworks, they have an emotional intelligence, I think, that is greater than the generations that have, like our generations that have come before. And their inquisitive nature on how and why, because of their raw, more emotional intelligence and leaning into the vast, you know, pinwheel of emotions and how within joy is gratitude and happiness and all these little micro, like to your point, like micro categories of the core human emotions. I was shocked to receive that Gen Z is going, because they are going to be the future leaders. And if they are the ones that are going to be hiring Mac and Millie one day, it gave me a lot of personal validation from, they didn't realize they were giving it to me, right? I thought, well, these are the ones in 10 or 15 years that'll be hiring Mac and Millie. And they're asking the right questions now, saying, how do I best support my cousin who comes over for Thanksgiving? That's on the spectrum that always runs up to my bedroom to hide. And I thought, that woman might be the head of HR one day who has the experience in a family setting, now is hearing it in a professional setting, and will continue to hear it through hopefully me and other voices, that when she gets to become the hiring manager in 10 to 15 years goes, oh yeah, I would love to see what Millie has to offer on the, you know, strategic end. And it becomes a no-brainer as to what that support looks like, because it's just already part of the implementation of what an employee workforce looks like. So I know Gen Z gets a bad rep. I'm like real pro Gen Z.
It's just like any generation, right? Gen X had certain advantages, certain disadvantages. Gen Z has certain advantages, disadvantages, and every generation will.
To be clear, I'm a geriatric millennial, though. I'm right on the cusp.
You're right on the cusp.
I'm an Xennial, to be fair. I am in that very micro generation. I'm 83, which I grew up without a cell phone, but I got a smartphone in college.
There you go.
So I guess you're a few years older though.
Yeah, I'm 52. So I literally had one foot in and out, but at the same time, we have to embrace that chaos. Mm-hmm. That's the only place opportunity is. And if we're not willing to wade down into it and build the resilience to be able to withstand whatever it takes to get to those places, especially if the enemy is afraid to go into chaos.
Yes.
That's my advantage. I will shake it up all day knowing that I can be resilient while other people will hesitate and wait to do whatever it is that they think they need to do next.
I really hope that even beyond special needs parenting, I really hope that through discussions like this, that all parents continue to choose that parenting is chaotic. It's just by nature chaotic. You're raising small humans, right, that are developing and growing. And it's hard to choose the hard within the hard. It is. It really is. And I hope that through discussions like this, people say, well, maybe if I do it once, I'm going to do it again. You know, my sister has three typical children, and her husband and her are taking them all to Japan this summer. And they're under the age of 10.
Wow.
And she goes, and every summer they do this. And she said, Sarah, why not? Why not? I mean, it's the same cost as going to the beach for a week. There's no reason. It's going to be really hard. But just like last summer in Italy, the kids are only going to remember eating gelato four times a day. They're going to eat sushi. You know, they're going to remember the rice patties and swimming in the ocean. Like it's hard, but it's always worth it. So I think I really hope these kind of conversations push even the typical, I don't want to say average, but the bell curve of folks to choose a harder, more leaning into the chaos, because it can create and open up a world, I think, where we understand more people and more experiences and just have a greater lens on life.
Absolutely. Sarah, I want to be respectful of your time. Can you tell us more about Saturday Stories? Can you tell us where we can learn more about you, hire you, bring you in to speak to our corporations, to our companies, et cetera?
Wonderful. Thank you. So Saturday Story began, really, I was a tried and true mommy blogger in Manhattan back in when I first had my first child, which expanded to Instagram. And I just really leaned into being vulnerable and sharing about the special needs parenting journey. So it started, Saturday Story was that I love Saturdays. I love the options that Saturdays had. And it was always just so exciting in New York, whether you were single, you know, married in a relationship or as a family or with a child. And that has evolved now to my advocacy work. I do talks on the inchstones over milestones mentality to employee resource groups, you know, just generalized HR conferences to just bind, whether it's the parents or the medical professionals, the related service professionals, that really anyone that's coming in touch with neurodivergent individuals, which is all of us these days, whether self-identified or not. And mostly share most of my professional wins on LinkedIn. So they can find me through Sarah Kearney and on LinkedIn as well. And my website, saturdaysstory.com.
I love it. Thank you so much for your time. Thank you for the work that you're doing. And I would be amiss not to thank Mark McGrath for the intro as well.
He's a good connector, that one.
I think so. I think he's tremendous. Thank you so much. I will talk to you soon.
Thanks, Marcus.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Okta Nonverba. If this message resonates with you, please share it out with others on social media. Hit that subscribe button and leave a review for the show anywhere you listen to podcasts. To learn more, please go to MarcusAureliusAnderson.com and join his Okta Nonverba Inner Circle to get exclusive content, news, and information. Until next time, remember, talk is cheap. Live your life based on actions, not words.